Paper 15 again, section 4, which is old single column, page 169. All right, like I mentioned at the end of last week's tour de force on the previous section, this is very much a corollary section, so we're just picking up right where we left off. They're going to give us just a little bit more on how the basics of the cosmological construct function. So let's jump in here.
4. Nebulae, the ancestors of universes. While creation and universe organization remain forever under the control of the infinite creators and their associates, the whole phenomenon proceeds in accordance with an ordained technique and in conformity to the gravity laws of force, energy, and matter. But there is something of mystery associated with the universal force charge of space. We quite understand the organization of the material creations from the ultimatonic stage forward, but we do not fully comprehend the cosmic ancestry of the ultimatons. We are confident that these ancestral forces have a paradise origin because they forever swing through pervaded space in the exact gigantic outlines of paradise. Though non-responsive to paradise gravity, this force charge of space, the ancestor of all materialization, does always respond to the presence of nether paradise, being apparently circuited in and out of the nether paradise center.
Okay. So let's kind of the two parts of that. At the beginning, you notice what they're trying to do. They're trying to get those who have a definite recognition of God, and most likely then some historical relationship with ideas about God as the creator and how the universe is related to God. You don't want to think of God in any expression, not just God the Father, but God of any flavor, as some sort of a micromanaging puppeteer of even, by and large, the creative act. Yes, from an eternity viewpoint, like they're saying, you have the universal creator behind all creation. But by and large, especially in all of the physical details that we're focusing on, God has set up definitive laws of physical things, and he's also behind these various agents of the physical, and they have, like they're saying, definite approaches to doing this. You have the architects of the master universe that have a very, top down from the absinthite down to the finite point of view. They recognize all of the issues in play. So, all of those subsidiary laws and beings are in charge of all those details. God isn't micromanaging the creation of every automaton. But certainly, God the Father wants, through the aisle, he can be cognizant of any automaton. Okay? But getting that whole micromanaging, or even, if you have some sort of like a deist notion of God, it's not even that God the Father, made it all as the watchmaker and, wound it up and then stepped aside. That's just not, not the system. And I think, any person who's been reading for a while completely recognizes that. But, you just recognize that they need to very much get this a person who has a recognition of God or has a, awareness of spiritual things to come to terms with the literalness of the physical world and, its laws and, to take all of the magic out of the physical domain. Okay, and then they go into, you know, what we so often refer to as the force charge of space. You know, here they're very much directly calling it that. You know, the primordial force that pervades all of pervaded space, the force charge of space. You know, that space is charged with this fact, this pre-energy fact. And it's called a force, not an energy, if you're using energy in that more specific sense of force, energy, power. It's a pre-energy fact, called a force, so that you don't think of it as some sort of ubiquitous reservoir of energy, you know, certainly nothing like kind of a modern notion of a zero-point energy or anything like that. It's not some reservoir of energy that if you build the right gizmo in your garage, you know, you can somehow tap into this and, you know, and supply the world's energy needs, okay? It's a pre-energy fact. It has no differential, you know, and that's fundamentally the difference between a force and an energy in the way they're using it. So you're going from something that's, you know, perfectly uniform in nature to something where there's a differential. There, you know, in other words, there's a difference between what's at this point and what's at this point, so that if you have two electrodes of some sort of a gizmo, you know, you can stick one here and one here, and there's a potential, there's a differential across that that could power something in a circuit, you know, flows downhill or whatever. You know, that's sort of a differential. You don't have that in the force. But definitely this this force charge of space is not, you know, in terms of physical issues, is not an ethereal, irrelevant fact. It is it's a very definitive fact. The automatons that are individuated out of it, you know, are really an individuation of it, remained dynamically coupled. Automatons push on the force charge, and the force charge push on the automatons. And the force charge can have structures in it, waves in it. I mean, that's a basic, you know, electromagnetic wave, you know, is a deformation of the force charge. You know, so it's a very important physical fact. You just have to recognize that as a thing, it's transcendent of the finite. Okay, so it doesn't have any sort of a finite differential. It's perfectly ubiquitous as a finite presence. So if it's doing something, you know, you're not going to see that from a finite point of view. Okay, and where that really comes in is this very kind of subtle fact that they're alluding to here. And I mentioned, I guess it was last time, wasn't it, or the time before, you know, we have these levels of space that, you know, go all the way around the center of all things, around the central universe, and that you have this definitive presence in those levels of the force charge. And back when we were talking about nether paradise, like they're alluding to there at the end, you know, we were trying to kind of think of ways of sort of visualizing or, you know, analogizing what they were telling us about the north-south differential and the east-west differential and how that imposes pattern upon the master universe. And in that discussion, we, you know, just sort of for ease of discussion, we said, well, just kind of think of that, you know, that one of those differentials is making a flow of something. Yeah, and so we were kind of thinking about like the super universe level as having a flow, you know, in it, that it flows around counterclockwise. Okay. Now, technically, you know, if you're really going to talk about something going around, for instance, that super universe circuit in that quote-unquote flow, okay, you're like picturing the Milky Way galaxy flowing around, okay? You know, or anything else, when they talk about paradise gravity, absolute gravity, circular gravity, remember how sometimes they'll use that distinction relative to linear gravity, you know, this simple, you know, clunk, this kind of, you know, Newtonian gravity, linear gravity. In contrast, they'll call the absolute gravity circular gravity, because through the dark gravity bodies, it imposes a circular, i.e., you know, around one of these circuits, manifestation rather than something, you know, linearly going towards the center of mass. Okay. And the force charge itself, like they're just pointing out, and they say that, though non-responsive to paradise gravity. Okay, so here's where we're getting a little bit more precise. You don't actually want to think of that force charge as something that's kind of like the old ether notion, you know, a fluid that's sort of in this that's in this donut, you know, and that fluid is flowing around. It's not like that. It's not responsive to paradise gravity in a very, in a simple, direct way like that. It's not a thing that's being made to go around by the aisle. However, if I imagine sprinkling a bunch of ultimatons into that tube of space, pervaded by this force charge, I will see, though, if I watch those ultimatons, I'll see them drift counterclockwise.
Would the force charge have an impact on fractals?
Not so much that as the similarity is that notion of a fractal where you have a certain pattern that is scale independent, you know, that it exists at all scales. You can, that's, you know, something can actually manifest in reality in that fractal-like way, that scale-independent way, if the source of what you're observing is transcendent. If it's transcendent of finite scales, it engages the finite at all scales simultaneously. So, you know, any omnipresent thing will manifest like that. It touches all sizes at the same time. And so if a pattern is coming from that, you'll see that pattern at all levels. That's a similar thing with the force charge. See that because it's a transcendent fact, because it's basically an absonite fact, okay, when it imposes itself on the, its behavior is manifest in the finite, it doesn't have any scale to it. It's scale independent, you know, and that's what I'm saying. It's totally uniform. It's exactly the same everywhere. Now, it's not directly what's going on here, but just a little aside, because I've brought this up before, to remind yourself that the basic manifestation of this force charge in terms of its what you see of it in physical phenomena, it's sort of a first order phenomenon, is that it's not this static, fluid, old ether-like thing. Everything in the universe is a motion. You know, we've talked about this many times. And what you observe is the basic manifestation of this fact of the force charge is there's a ubiquitous, a universal motion that it pervades. Okay, but it's not a finite motion, so it's not vectorial. It's not starting at some point in space and moving out from it, or, you know, or going from one point to another. It's a universal outward fact, so that if you put a marker dot on it, like an ultimaton or a photon or something that doesn't have motion independent relative to the force charge, it's going to show you what the force charge is doing that it's sort of embedded in. You'll see, like, you dump a whole pile of photons on a spot and they all go outward, okay, at a non-relative speed called the speed of light. I mean, that speed of light, quote unquote, is also the speed of an ultimaton and the speed of anything that doesn't have a mass, that's basically just showing you that fundamental background motion that is the force charge. So, you know, if you did that experiment, like I was saying, of sprinkling the ultimatons, okay, in the first thing you would see, if you generate some of them at a point, they all go outward from that point, like the photons coming off of that light bulb, they go outward in every direction at the speed of light. Okay, but setting that aside, You know, and kind of going back to like we were doing when we were talking about Nether Paradise, there's sort of this hidden flow-like motion that you can't see at all looking at the force charge itself. You know, you don't see it going around. It's like, well, think about what I just said. I mean, how could you see the force charge going around? There's absolutely no difference from one point to another. How could you tell if a particular point had moved? I mean, you know, if it did, immediately there's a point coming right that's totally identical to the one that was there before. I mean, there's no way that you could tell. But the moment you put on something that has a finite footprint, like an automaton, so that you can point at it, you know, you notice that you've got to move your finger to follow it. You know, it's going around. Okay? Okay, so that's what they're, you know, what's between the lines of all that they just pointed out. You have this force charge in the super universe level, and anything that's manifested from it immediately allows you to observe this counterclockwise swing. You know, there's a swing to everything, goes around this curved path.
So essentially, throughout the whole master universe, we're a giant record platter, except certain bands go in certain directions opposite each other.
You have these, right, you have these sort of just uniform record platter-like, you know, channels.
DVDs.
You know, right, you know, this channel goes like this, and this channel goes like this. Everything is uniformly going along, and, you know, this way in the first outer space level, this way in the super universe level. And,
but all under the influence of the force charge.
Right, so everything that's going on, you know, has that motion underneath it. I mean, so, you know, the objects in a galaxy can be doing all kinds of various things, but what they're all doing in common is going along. So, you know, and everything does. It's so, I mean, it's not like you can somehow do an experiment and directly measure this inside. I mean, everything is going with it. So, I mean, as far as you're concerned, in some sort of a reference frame of an experiment, you know, you're motionless. But really, you know, you're in motion around this circuit.
Everything's turning.
Everything's going with it, yeah.
You were talking about the sections. If we were to look down upon on Orvontan, you would see the 10 major sectors.
Yeah, down in the Milky Way galaxy, basically, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then with the 7 super universes going around Paradise, there's a kind of a compression and expansion as they march around the actual sector.
Right. Right, that
universe.
Yeah, that was the whole issue of what's of all of the local universes or minor sectors within a major sector, that there's a differential, you know, gravity differential, tidal differential, see, across the galaxy because of the dark gravity bodies.
From inside to outside.
Yeah, right. So as you know, anything goes around. You know, if you have two things going around, you know, they're going to have a tendency to be drawn closer together when they're on the inside going around and then spread back out. You know, so there's that sort of compression, expansion sort of, you know, cycle as things go around, as the record platter of the whirl in the force charge that, you know, is underneath the Milky Way galaxy turns. Yeah.
So we have that underlying whirl of...
Right. So you have the flow, you have the whirl, and then you have all the stuff and all the linear gravity stuff that it's doing.
What got me about those lines is this non-responsive to Paradise gravity, this force charge of face, does always respond to the presence of Nether Paradise. And I pictured the automatons being responsive. But then the next sentence says, being apparently circuited in and out of Nether Paradise, so then that threw me.
Right. That, I mean, you have to go back to, I don't want to go totally back to the Nether Paradise section and rework all of that, but that's that north-south differential that they talk about, that it, you know, that's part of the manifestation that is Paradise. that, think of that north-south differential as what's responsible for there being a directionality in these circuits. Okay?
It's not like a respiration inside, in and out of
North. Right. You got to remember, all of this is happening. I mean, the Isle of Paradise is actually outside of space and all this. So you don't have some simple, you know, circulatory system, finite circulatory system. But yeah, just so separate that pump analogy from the actual flow. Don't try to somehow stick the pump into the flow so that you can directly see it, you know, causing this.
I'm seeing it go in the bottom and out the top is what I'm seeing.
Right, but that's, it's not top and bottom. It's all nether paradise. It's north, south,
yes,
across.
Top, right?
Okay, so. Okay. But see, that whole point does always respond to the presence of nether paradise. I mean, you know, like they were saying, where was that? In the exact gigantic outlines of paradise. I mean, that's the whole point. I mean, it's why are there these elliptical circuits? Because the aisle, through the dark gravity bodies, says so. Okay? It imposes that structure and that pattern. The two of those two facts together impose that upon the master universe. And so, like they're saying, not coincidentally, it looks like what gave rise, what's behind it. You know, this source expresses itself in what's, you know, in what's manifested. They are elliptical, not circular, and they are they're by and large flat. You know, they're not a spherical region. You know, they're a region that's more in the plane, like the aisle is not a sphere. You know, okay. So without, you know, getting into the sort of all the subtleties of that trans finite to finite linkage, just recognize it. That's what they're getting at. So I just wanted to stress that because I don't want anyone to, you know, to start thinking simplistically when we use that flow-like analogy. Don't think of this force charge as a fluid that's flowing around like a river. Okay.
I still don't know why they're saying in and out, but that's okay.
In the south, out the north.
Okay.
You know, like I said, just if you go back and read the Nether Paradise section, now you can get that. Yeah.
Well, isn't that the same when you put iron filings with a bar magnet? That's what you see, the same pattern.
Right. See, yeah, and all you want to do is just make sure you don't get too literal with that analogy, because
it
obviously isn't literal.
Mm-hmm. Circuited in and out of the Nether Paradise center. It's not necessarily in and out. It's circuited in the Nether Paradise Center. I mean...
Oh, yeah. Very good. If they put a comma there.
Well, I mean, the Isle of Paradise is, you know, is the paradise source and center. Okay? So, you know, it is the anchor point, you know, yes. But that whole bit about the, you know, the definitive non-varying north-south differential, as they talk about, and then sometimes the east-west differential. I mean, all that sort of stuff is what they're alluding to there. Of thinking about these differentials that stem from paradise as being behind us. I mean, obviously, you know, if there's some tendency for things to go around, there has to be some differential behind that. It can't just magically come out of nowhere. Okay, and like we pointed out, I mean, the fact that they alternate in directions, you know, the levels, that one is clockwise and the next one, or the one is counterclockwise and the next one is clockwise. The Isle of Paradise couldn't do that itself. There's no alternate aspect of the aisle. But there is, you know, this is not coming directly from the aisle. It's going through the dark gravity bodies. And there are alternate circuits of dark gravity bodies. That's how that alternate, you know, footprint of the aisle, you know, it's not a direct footprint. The direct footprint of the aisle is perfectly spherical at any point in space. But the footprint of the aisle through the dark gravity bodies is very much quasi-planar, elliptical, etc. All right, so that's the basics there.
The Paradise Force organizers transmute space potency into primordial force and evolve this prematerial potential into the primary and secondary energy manifestations of physical reality. When this energy attains gravity-responding levels, the power directors and their associates of the superuniverse regime appear upon the scene and begin their never-ending manipulations designed to establish the manifold power circuits and energy channels of the universes of time and space. Thus does physical matter appear in space, and so is the stage set for the inauguration of universe organization.
So that, you know, that last part is kind of referring back to what they were saying at the beginning of the previous paragraph, that you have this very definitive process and that finally gets sort of all the stuff into existence that you make universes out of. It isn't just a finger snap and, you know, and the universe is there. You have this whole process to get the stuff, and then the stuff is assembled into a universe. Okay, and that the details of that are basically referring you up to paper 42, where they're talking about the sequence of actualization of going from, you know, the pure potential in the picture of the space potency to this initial actuality of the primordial force, but really a potential in an energy sense. So you go from space potency to primordial force to emergent energy. And the emergent energy, in other words, emerging differential that you could somehow measure with finite measurement techniques, this begins to manifest, and it does so in two phases in general. And that's why there are two orders of master force organizers, the primaries and their associates. You have the primary and secondary energy. The primary energy is puissant energy. They call it up in paper 42. You know, that's very emerging fact, which is brought into existence via the presence of the primary eventuated master force organizers, those primary beings. In their presence, they make a whirl in the force charge. It's a very much a record platter-like whirl. They initiate this as a transcendent imposition. No finite process is, you know, bringing this into existence. An absonite being is bringing this, imposing this upon the finite. Okay? Making a differential between the force charge here has this whirl in it, the force charge here doesn't. See, there's a differential. It's the beginnings of an energy.
It has to be a being that can grab this, that slips through any finite.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Okay, so the primary one, you know, establishes puissant energy, an initial differential. And then the associates step in, and they continue the process. What you actually have is there's beings involved, but it's an evolutionary process. You're evolving this into an actuality. The first step is this whirl, and then you're going to, the associates are going to continue the process of condensing that whirl into automatons. They, you know, if they fully do what they can do, the whole world, you know, is individuated into automatons, and there is no whirl anymore. Okay, you know, that whirl is bottled up into the automatons. You know, the motion of that whirl is bottled up inside of all those automatons. All that motion becomes that internal motion. You know, the quote-unquote axial revolution, you know, one of the fundamental motions of an automaton. You know, so just literally think of, you know, you have all of this motion, bottle it up in little packages, okay? And when it's all bottled up into automatons, you know, there's no whirl anymore. Okay? So,
you can imagine that velocity.
going into a dimension like an
all. Yeah. Something that's, you know, yeah, that's a real energetic little bottle there. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Super pill.
Yeah. But you can't unleash that by any finite process. No finite process is going to unravel that automaton. Okay? Because a transcendent being, you know, literally the associate transcendental master force organizers, you know, bottled it. And that which they did, no finite process can put us under. Because it's an absinite imposition. Okay, so that's the secondary energy. So you have this emergent energy. So the first, the primary is the puissant. The secondary is gravity energy, they call it. That's automatons. You know, so it goes from the whirl to automatons. Primary, secondary, puissant, gravity. Why is it gravity energy? Because once you finally have an automaton, now you have that circular gravity manifested of paradise. Like I said, you sprinkle the automatons there and they'll go, they will drift around in that circle.
Automaton is now gravity, paradise gravity responsive.
Right, responding, yeah.
But it's not...
Not linear gravity responding. It's not, it doesn't have any mass.
Yeah.
Okay? I mean, even, you know, you build up 100 automatons, you know, into a full system, you know, and add that little bit that makes it a thing we call a photon, and it still doesn't have mass.
Okay. But its motion now is a result of the whirl, not a result of paradise gravity grabbing a hold of it.
No, the I mean, for one thing, you know, definitely an automaton will be caught in the whirl and go around, but it now responds to circular gravity, to absolute gravity, to paradise gravity, and will, you know, and you'll see it go around the circuit. You know, it's not like you make one. And it just sits there, and the whirl, you know, heads on down the road, and the automaton is left sitting there. No, the whirl and the automaton, everything, you know, goes with it. I mean, you have this initial response, collective response of the whirl. I mean, the whirl goes around, too.
Are automatons something that are revealed in the Urantia book, or were they known before the book came?
No, I mean, they're completely unknowable right now. Utterly unknowable. There's no way any scientist right now is going
to... It's
impossible for them to be talking about them because it's completely beyond any conception we have right now. It's a sub-elect... Yeah, it's definitely not even a word. They're not even using the word. They're using the basic coinage of the O-N suffix like we name particles, electron, proton, you know, neutron, that sort of O-N suffix to name them.
Do they think the smallest particle is not quark?
Well, I mean, see, again, smallest is a very curious thing in with those imaginary particles, because, you know, they aren't really quarks. And so they have properties that you wouldn't initially think. You know, if they tell you that a proton is made out of 3 quarks, you think, oh, well, the quarks are smaller then. Well, yes and no. They actually are more massive than the proton.
Just take your word.
And the reason you can have such a notion is because there isn't any attempt to make it logical. It's just mathematical. Mathematically, you can have this construct called a quark, where each of them, you know, has more energy by themselves than the 3 of them together in the system that you call the proton. Yeah. So, I mean, it's... But you don't have to worry about all that stuff. You don't have to, you know, because there are no quarks.
What about strings?
There are no strings. There are no quarks. There is nothing like it. See, all that stuff is an attempt to try to fabricate some magical answer with finite things to what isn't what is fundamentally a sub-electronic. Maybe I should say it. You're using electronic level like notions. They, you know, a quark is a notion that has an electronic level energy, a big one, like I was just saying. But the structure of a particle, like a proton, you know, it doesn't have, the internal structure is, if you will, is not electronic level, it's sub-electronic. There's a whole domain of more fundamental physical phenomena than a collection of 100 ultimatons, which is a particle, okay, that they know nothing about. All of the energies, say, of an ultimaton or collections of ultimatons, even a complete 100 ultimatons, in current physics, the energy of all those things is zero. It has no electronic level energy. So in other words, it has no existence in current science. Okay? It has no charge, no mass, no energy, because all those things are electronic level facts. All of this motion is a motion, an energy that we don't recognize.
They basically don't know what they're doing.
Right. So instead of going down to a more fundamental thing to explain the internal nature of a proton, they create this magical thing that actually is up. They put that which is above, below, and inside, things like a Higgs boson and stuff like that. You're trying to explain the fundamental origin of mass with something that is super, super high energy rather than sub-energy. That's the whole point that the revolutionaries are trying to give us.
Is the Higgs boson the postulate, is that the god
particle, that's what they call it. Right.
Oh, that's
they
what
call
see.
It, but
is that their attempt at postulating what we're referring to as the ultimate?
It's their attempt to create a rationalization scheme for the origin of mass. Okay. But it has utterly no relationship to ultimatons and all that sub-electronic. It's literally diametrically opposite. It's something that's up from what you know, and this is down, below, underneath, what we currently know.
Because you say these are people that are imposing their spirit consciousness on top of, their limited physical viewing.
Well, calling it a God particle is not imposing your spiritual consciousness. That's trying to usurp religion and point out that any notion that you need God is delusional. And that we can point to a particle, that has all the properties of your God. It's facetious. Okay. But let's see. Okay, so Just notice, they're pointing to a lot of stuff back in the Isle of Paradise paper, a lot of stuff up in paper 42, so that if you want to really study the details, it's basically footnotes, sort of, see paper 42, they're just reminding you, or if you've read those, this is just a little synopsis of paper 42 to remind you of all that and to see it in place here. That's the point of these two paragraphs to a large degree. Okay.
This segmentation of energy is a phenomenon which has never been solved by the physicists of Nebadon. Their chief difficulty lies in the relative inaccessibility of the Paradise Force organizers for the living power directors, though they are competent to deal with space energy, do not have the least conception of the origin of the energies they so skillfully and intelligently manipulate.
So all the power beings, be they the seven supreme power directors or the supreme power centers or the master physical controllers, all those power beings have no clue about this whole transmutation phenomenon, this pre-energy phenomenon, okay? And the force organizers are not talking. Okay. Now the one little physics fact in there, I always point out they're very careful about their choice of words. In a simple way, like when we were just talking about having a whirl and having the whirl condense into ultimatons, taking all that big macroscopic fact and individuating it into ultimatons. There's a slight little issue with calling it an individuation, because that will tend to invoke sort of an idea that you have this automaton just sitting there with nothing around it, you know, in a quote-unquote vacuum. But the automaton stays coupled to the force charge. Okay, so another way of thinking about it is you have this force charge and you've made segments of it, hence the segmentation as opposed to individuation. But that, so they're being very precise there, just to kind of use that choice of words to remind you that one of the fundamental properties of an automaton is it's dynamically coupled to the force charge. It pushes on the force charge, and the force charge pushes on it. Okay? It's dynamically, momentum coupled to the force charge. Okay? That's why you can make an electron microscope. You know, because the electrons move, they push on the force charge, they make waves in the force charge, and those waves you can build a microscope with. Okay?
To jump back a couple of paragraphs, still I'm kind of in a quandary. We do not fully comprehend the cosmic ancestry of the automaton. How come?
Right, that's just what they're referring to here again. The force organizer is not talking. Okay, that whole to go from force charge to puissant energy to automaton is a physics that no finite being knows.
Even the
power beings, you know, let alone the revelators. Okay. Right. So.
Is there a planet where that secret is?
Yeah, planet transcendence. Yeah.
Don't worry about the architects. The architects and the masters.
Right. Obviously, transcendentalists understand, you know, this stuff. But, you know, and the thing is, I mean, we don't need to know all those details. I mean, you know the basics. You know, I just described it. You know, you go from that primordial force, that force charge of space, to a whirl, to automatons. And, you know, exact details of how that happens is, you know,
so
not that important.
An automaton has mass.
No.
No mass.
No mass, no charge, no energy, no nothing that we know of. It has energy in the more generalized Urantia book use of the word energy. Okay? It has sub-electronic level energy. It has energy that we currently... It has a dynamics, a motion, a differential that we currently can't see, can't measure, know nothing about. All instruments record. You know, this room is filled with collections of 100 automatons that have no additional electronic level energy, you know, motions added to them. If you add anything, you're going to get something that we'll notice, like charge or mass or just an energy that will...
100 automatons is... But equivalent of like an electron?
If you take 100 automatons and then you do something with, you add to that, you know, you add a very simple unidirectional rotation to that, and you get an electron.
Wouldn't that be its natural movement anyway? I mean, what do you have to
that's
add?
That's what I'm saying. There's no natural movement.
Right. You put together, you can put together 100 automatons in that, and you have this electronic level base. It has no electronic level energy. That's something, you know, think of it as the foundation. It has no floors. We can measure floors. We can measure a first floor, a second floor, a third floor, but we can't measure the foundation. So we think that the room is a vacuum. We think the room has nothing in it, but it's really filled with collections of 100 automatons. Okay?
It has to be more than that before we can...
Right. No, not more automatons. Just adding, taking that system and, you know, doing
making it do something.
Yeah, making it do something. Okay.
But that base.
Like
system,
a photon.
But it's an absonite phenomenon. So that's one of the reasons.
Well, no, I mean, an automaton is a finite phenomenon.
The automaton is a finite.
Yeah. It's the force charge that's really an absonite phenomenon. Okay. It's just, it's a subelectronic level finite. It's finite because it's here and not there. I mean, you know, an automaton has a radius. It's a finite fact. It has a finite radius. Okay, but it has no mass. And it's because, and the challenge there is, remember, it's not a universe of mass or matter even. Or even things in the sense we normally think of. It's a universe of motion. Fundamentally, everything is a motion. An automaton has three properties, three motions. That's all it has. And none of those motions are anything that we can measure. Okay?
Even when they're glommed together in 100.
Even when they're glommed together in 100. Right. Yeah? Yeah, it's just we don't have any tools yet to measure those kind of differentials. We have very crude tools.
So if you had 100 automatons, you wouldn't be able to detect it. But if it started having motion,
once it had some
appear then like it came out of nowhere?
Right. I mean, yeah. Yes. Exactly. And that's exactly what happens. One of the things that the physicists, when they watch a lot of unstable particles, you know, there's a lot of things, you know, an electron and a proton are stable. But you take some other particle that they make in a particle accelerator or something, they only last for a little while. And then they think they quote-unquote decay. Okay, they think that you've got this single thing and it's going along for a little ways and then it breaks apart into two things that are stable. Okay, like maybe an electron and a neutrino. Okay. But think about this, and you can make all the mathematics work fine. But physically, that's illogical. Once you know that, or once you demand that this particle that's going along that you're watching is more than a mathematical equation, if you demand it to be an objective fact, for instance, a collection of 100 automatons, okay, it goes along, you have 100 automatons, and then suddenly you have 200 automatons because you got two particles. Automatons don't just come out of nowhere. Okay? That isn't what actually happens. Particles don't, quote-unquote, decay. There's a collision. This particle that you can see, because it has electronic level properties, bumps into an electronic level base, a collection of 100 automatons with no additional stuff. And some of that electronic level energy transfers over. And so now there's two things that you can see, okay? 200 automatons come in, 200 automatons go. Automatons are conserved in all finite processes. You can't create or destroy automatons. That's a conservation law that science doesn't recognize, but they could have easily hypothesized long ago if they demanded it to be logical, okay, rather than just mathematical.
So this is the underlying sort of matrix of everything upon which everything is created. Where does the thing that we're adding to it come from?
One of the places is they're just pointing out here. The power beings come in and take automatons and do things with them. Okay? So some of that additional higher organization, that additional motion, is added by beings. But then there's also...
it's basically what they're creating is dirt to start with.
right? Yeah. They're making... Yeah, I mean, so, you know, you can have all kinds of analogies of clay, you know, or whatnot, you know. But the whole point is that without trying to totally... write down a tally of where everything is and how, I mean, just think of it in general terms right now, that there's motion everywhere. And going from an electronic level base to an electron is adding motion to it. There's motion everywhere in the environment. It can get to it one way or another, whether or not it just is sort of a natural physical process, quote unquote, or a being is involved in it. It's all about just compounding motion added upon motion. Okay, and the tricky thing about it is basically, when you're talking about adding these motions, these are you're talking about adding absonite rotations, for instance, to an object. You're not talking about taking this electronic level base and spinning it like a top, you know, in a finite sense. You're spinning it around an absonite axis.
It's where the finite meets the absonite. It's where a finite automaton is linked and coupled to the absonite force charge of space. And I figure that's kind of enough for me at this point.
But we are, you know, building upon that. I mean, we're going beyond that. You know, we're thinking about more than that relationship between the force charge and the ultimon. You know, we're thinking about this collection of 100 ultimons now, and trying to understand what's the difference between that, and what's the difference between an electron and an electron neutrino. That collection of 100 ultimons is being rotated in an absonite sense in two different ways. And you don't need to think about it any more specific than that, but just recognize that that's what these, you know, what's going on with this is that you're just taking the automatons and you're compounding them into more and more complex structures, but it's not a simple additive thing like we currently think in the billiard ball model of the universe, where in order to make bigger things you got to find more billiard balls to put in the pile. Okay. You're not adding billiard balls. You're adding motion. And not motion of billiard balls. Motion. Everything is a motion.
Everything's turning.
An automaton is not a little billiard ball. It is just a motion. Okay? And I know that's very hard to wrap your mind around, but that's what they're trying to get us to recognize. That's why we have such magical physics right now, because we're trying to explain everything as a universe of matter, a universe of billiard balls. You know, it's just fancy Newtonian physics made magical. Okay, the moment that you had to invoke magic is the moment that you knew that your initial assumption was no longer adequate to explain it. Okay, if you have to make the billiard ball magical in order to get it to match what you're observing, then it's not a billiard ball. It's like, well, that's all there is. It has to be a billiard. No, you don't have to assume that. If you have creativity, you might imagine something else. Okay. All right. Okay. So that's really the basics. It's kind of a little bit of indirect physics that they're throwing in there, just to remind you of what they said up front. That there's a lot of really complicated, very hard to understand, many ways transcendent things with lots of beings involved that eventually get you to have a bunch of gas, a bunch of atoms, okay? A big pile of gas in space, okay? Hydrogen gas, you know, helium gas, whatever, gas. You know, of course, the main thing is hydrogen gas, okay? A bunch of atoms spread through space that can be a nebula. A big region of gas, atoms, gaseous atoms.
Working material.
Right. Raw material to do something with. Okay? All right.
Paradise Force organizers are nebulae organizers, originators, sorry. They are able to initiate about their space presence the tremendous cyclones of force which, when once started, can never be stopped or limited until all pervading forces are mobilized for the eventual appearance of the ultimatonic units of universe matter. Thus are brought into being the spiral and other nebulae, the mother wheels of the direct origin suns and their varied systems. In outer space, there may be seen 10 different forms of nebulae, phases of primary universe evolution. And these vast energy wheels had the same origin as did those in the 7 super universes.
Okay, so one little thing there, you know, of using the wheel analogy like they do here. You know, phases of primary universe evolution. Remember what the word universe literally means. One, turning, right? So it's a very direct picture, you know, that by and large, you know, how everything gets, you know, what you end up building, like the whole Orvinton system, starts with some primary building blocks that are one-turnings, whirls in the force charge that are condensed into automatons that collect together into collections of 100, you know, so that you have particles, and particles collect together into atoms, and atoms, you know, et cetera. It just builds up.
Isn't the full definition one turning on itself?
I guess that's the same thing. No, I
mean, it you know, it's just literally, you know, one turning, you know. But, you know, so that's that primary universe evolution. See, that first part that they're pointing out there is kind of what we were talking about with the primary and associate force organizers. One starts the whirl, and the other condenses the whirl into automatons. And obviously that associate force organizer has control over the, I mean, how much of this whirl is going to get condensed, you know, and when. And now think about what we were talking about last time with the Milky Way galaxy, that you fundamentally have this ongoing whirl that you can kind of think of, you know, as a record platter with 10 pie-like wedges on, you know, that's turning around, the 10 major sectors. That has to go on. You have to have that ongoing 10 major sector whirl. You can't condense that whirl totally into automatons. So the associate ones are not condensing that whole whirl. They're basically leaving that whirl alone, letting it go on in its immutable form. Remember what they how they said that? Can never be stopped or limited until, you know, an associate one starts condensing it. But unless an associate one condenses it, that primary one starts up that whirl, and it will just go on forever, completely unchanged, okay? An absolutely constant fact, because it's being imposed transcendently. It's like, you know, all of these various non-changing facts that we observe, like, you know, you put a particle in front of you and it has a certain mass, you know, a proton, say, has a certain mass. Does that mass change with time? Yeah. You know, so the fact that that mass doesn't change with time or with place, I can move it anywhere, it has the same mass, it's not a function of space or time. It obviously, that ongoingness and that immutability, you know, to that complete indifference to finite, you know, space and time, means that that's linked to some transcendent fact. I mean, of course, the aisle. Okay, the mass is independent of space and time because the aisle is transcendent of space and time. Yeah, you know, the aisle is changeless. Therefore, that footprint, that shadow cast by the aisle, property like charge or mass or, you know, even the speed of light or, you know, or any property that's universal and changeless, so is a shadow cast by the changelessness, the motionlessness of the aisle.
Property giver.
Right. Okay. Let's see. What else did we have? Oh, just the one little comment. Anyone who's had any astronomy knows that in the 30s, Hubble started playing with this notion of trying to categorize galaxies that we see, you know, into different types and stuff. And so they're giving you a little suggestion here that when you're thinking about the phases of primary universe evolution, so just the phases of the primary evolution, not sort of subsequent secondary issues and whatnot that might give you different forms of things, but they're suggesting that sort of this, the basic units go through a series of phases that are 10 in number, so that you know, they're giving you a hint to, and you're studying out there, see if you can find that, they're saying. Seeing if you can differentiate between primary and secondary issues. And then amongst the primary things, can you can you break it into 10 types? Why might they suggest that? Well, if you look into this, you'll see that over the decades, astronomers keep dreaming up new notions. It's a lot like trying to divide all of the living creatures into different categories, you know, different genus, species, families, you know, all those sort of designations. The more we stare at it, the more we think, well, maybe I should break this into two as well, you know, and we just get more and more and more and more types. They're trying to give us some benchmarks, you know, with the number of phyla, say, or with the number of different phases here, you know, so that you have a definitive anchor point, and then you can think about the complexities from there. It's kind of like this chart here. This isn't everything. It's just trying to give you some of the basic foundational patterns. And then there's all kinds of secondary patterns of interactions, you know, that are built upon that. But there's a nice, simple foundation. There aren't a million different primary phases. Okay? You know, there may be a million different, you know, or a thousand different, well, that one's kind of different than that one, and it's kind of different than that one, you know, that sort of thing. But if you can just step back, you're saying, you'll notice that there's 10 primary phases. Okay. So they occasionally try to help us a little bit here like this. Because we have no sort of objective reference frame to sort this out. So they'll give you little clues like that.
Well, I just wanted to say that I am so totally blown away by this image of a being who is able to initiate about its presence, a tremendous cyclone of force. I mean, doesn't that just blow your mind, the thought?
Right, and he doesn't even, like, stand there and spin.
No.
He just, he embodies the potential of that motion. He just, in his presence, it just is.
I know. Yeah.
And see, by and large, all of the power beings work that same way. You know, Master Physical Controller, you know, it isn't like he's got a toolbox of wrenches and he's doing all sorts of turning and flipping and, you know, and he just has a presence that he has control over, you know, and if he thinks in a certain way, he just imposes things on matter. You know, the primary associators, those, that particular flavor of Master Physical Controller, I mean, in just in their presence, DNA, you know, of a prokaryote is assembled. You know, all those atoms just come together. Okay.
You know, play devil's advocate. Mm-hmm. What is the difference between one of these master force organizers that starts this and magic? I mean, it's magic. I mean, it sounds magical when you describe it because we don't understand.
It sounds mysterious, but not, see, it's not magical because it's causal. That whirl is caused by something.
Okay.
It's caused by a being's action. So it's not magical. Many things in current physics have no causal agent.
Okay.
It's magical.
They won't give it a causal agent until they can prove it. They have to have more proof that there is.
Sure, there is that. But just notice one of the subtexts here. No wonder that some of these things are just treated magically. The causal agent is a being,
right,
and an absonite being at that.
Yeah, they can't grasp.
You don't exactly have a place for that in current physics.
Right.
Okay.
Right. They'll just look at you like, yeah.
You know, they'll say, what's the, you know, the question is not what's the difference between that and magic. See, the question they would ask me is, what's the difference between a force organizer and a fairy?
Yeah, right.
Exactly.
Okay. You know, as extreme as the notion of a force organizer is in current physical thinking, there are many, many things that we can directly observe, that we can pin down quite definitively, that force you to an inexorable conclusion. There has to be something unseen causing this. Okay? I mean, because I'm a scientist and I believe in a causal universe. Things don't happen without a cause. I've carefully assessed everything, and all I can see is this, and it does something. And things don't just do something because. They only do something if they're caused to do something. You know, so, you know, you can deduce an unseen fact, even an unseeable fact, okay, if you demand a logical universe. But if you let go of a logical universe, then, you know, the process doesn't force you to the recognition that there's something that you can't measure causing this. You just say it just happens magically. You don't need a cause for radioactivity in current science. It just happens magically. It's a causeless notion, you know, or some, there can be nothing in front of me in current physics, and suddenly there's something, an electron and a positron, say, spring into existence in front of me for no reason. Nothing caused it. It just does it itself. It's like, well, why does it do that? Well, because I need one of those particles to explain this. I mean, it's an ad hoc magical imposition. You just make something magically happen if you need it to happen for your rationalization scheme.
Because they cannot allow for it to have been a being that caused it.
Yeah, I mean, certainly not going to allow that. You know, but even, you know, forget about the things that we now know you can't understand without introducing a being into the picture. There's an awful lot of things that, if you would just treat them logically, they point to absonite phenomena.
But aren't some scientists so awestruck by the organizational stuff that they see that they suspect that there must be a being even if they can't grasp it? I mean,
sure, but, you know, what kind of a being are they invoking? They're invoking the magic man. You know, it's like, well, you know, I can't explain this with electrons. Therefore, there maybe that whole Christian notion of the magic man must be real. You know, it's like, no, that there's not a magic man either. That's kind of what we started out with. They're trying to remind you, there is no God is not the magic man that waves a wand and makes matter come into existence. It's a purely logical, causal phenomenon. Yes, it involves beings, but no magic wands. It involves hands that grab a hold of things and manipulate it, mold it. You know, okay. There's just so many things. You know, you don't. When you get to a, when we got to a roadblock in our scientific pursuit, people decided the only solution was to cease being a scientist. Okay. And it broke into two camps, a camp that believe that matter is magical, and a camp that believe that you don't need to make matter magical. We've always had the magic answer. There's a magic man that does all these things that I can't explain with physics equations. So, you know, so either you believe that matter just, you know, is innately magical and just does things itself. You know, or, you know, it's like, it's neither, guys. It's neither. Okay? You need a causal explanation or you're not a scientist.
Because I don't see how a science can ever arrive at the realities things without revelation.
Right. What does it say? That sentence is in the book. It is impossible, you know, to construct a logical cosmology without revelation. That's why we get revelation. It's the only way that you can get past these inevitable roadblocks. It has to be revealed to you how you go from point A to point B. Okay, so now let's think about these nebulae, and if you know anything about the history of astronomy, you know that way back at the beginning of the 20th century. They called a lot of things that we now call galaxies nebulae. And so you might think that when they start talking about things that, you know, they currently call galaxies and they're calling them nebulae, oh, this is just written by someone back in the beginning of the 20th century who's using that old speak. No, They're trying to get you to not think so simplistically. The word nebulae is a, or nebula, you know, is a very appropriate word to use as a general term, because whether or not the whether or not the object that you're looking at is literally still just a region of gas, or it's now a collection of stars that are going around in some big spiral galaxy, it all starts out as gas. Okay, it doesn't. You don't just have, you know, out of nowhere a collection of stars just spring into existence and start going around in a spiral galaxy. Okay, those stars in that galaxy condensed out of a region of gas. Okay, and that region of gas had a spiral structure before there were stars. Okay, and all these, so they're trying to get us to recognize that if we just if we allow a little bit more sophistication, the word nebula is a good general term, okay, to talk about all these things. And it's sort of a secondary issue about whether or not there's stars that have condensed out of the gas or not. Gas, a region of gas that's going to do something is the starting point in general. Okay? All right.
Nebulae vary greatly in size and in the resulting number and aggregate mass of their stellar and planetary offspring. A sun-forming nebula, just north of the borders of Orvantan, but within the super-universe space level, has already given origin to approximately 40,000 suns, and the mother wheel is still throwing off suns, the majority of which are many times the size of yours. Some of the larger nebulae of outer space are giving origin to as many as 100 million suns.
Okay, now, the thing that you don't appreciate just in this paragraph, that you have to understand, or that you have to bring into this paragraph from other discussions in the book, is when they're talking like this, like when they're saying approximately 40,000 suns, okay, this is a, they're talking about a sun-forming nebula. The sun-forming process is episodic. There's phases. You know, it starts out as all gas. Some stars get made, and then it's just stars and gas for a while, and then there's a new phase where some more stars are made. So, you know, if this nebula, you know, in that general sense, is in one of those phases where new stars are being made, then it's a star-forming nebula for that stretch of time. Okay, it doesn't. So you're not looking for a galaxy that just has 40,000 stars in it. Could have a lot of stars in it, but right now it's going through a star-forming phase, and there's already been 40,000 that have been made in this current phase. However many were made prior to that, you know, you don't know, but we do know what this object is.
Does the gas have to start to burn before it can start making suns?
Well, I mean, you know, the gas just coalesces into a sphere, and then there's internal processes that we don't want to get into right here, you know, that actually
turn into a ball of fire.
Yeah, get it to start releasing some of this bottled up energy. I mean, we know about all the processes up to the point of nuclear processes. We know it up to the secondary level. Current science knows nothing of the primary energy generation mechanism because it has to do with that whole sub-electronic domain that we don't know about. Okay, we'll get into that a little bit as we go on. Okay, so what is this object? No. Okay, so let's remind ourselves of this picture. You know, that's in the southern hemisphere that we saw last week, where you're looking and, you know, and you're seeing the band of the Milky Way, and you can see the two Magellanic clouds, you know, right here, and those two little fuzzballs above the plane of the Milky Way there. Okay, that in that image. Okay, remember that. So I'm standing out here in the disk of the plane of the Milky Way, and I'm looking, you know, through the disk, and I can see it. Here's the, you know, the band of the Milky Way across the sky. You know, right there, I'm looking dead to the center of the Milky Way galaxy, that bright area there, the thicker part, central bulge. Okay, so if I'm looking, so that, you know, if that's the direction towards the center of the galaxy, remember that's also the direction towards the center of all things, because we're pretty much on the outside, the Milky Way, going around. So if I'm looking, see, towards that center here in this picture, you know, visualize it here in the room. So I'm looking this direction. You know, the super universe levels around like this. So if I look a little bit to the right, I'm looking down the super universe level ahead of the Milky Way. I'm looking towards the first super universe that's ahead of me in the stream here. Okay. If you do that, I mean, if you look just a little bit to the right of the center and a little bit up, you know, just a little, sort of right in here, there's a little galaxy in there. It's the one they're talking about here. See, it's just north of the borders of Orvandon, but in the super universe space level. It's in the first super universe. We can see one little galaxy. Okay, we can't see the great big galaxy because it's in the plane, totally blocked. We can't see the great big galaxy in the first super universe. Okay, but a little galaxy that's above it, you know, in the same way that the large and small Magellanic clouds here are a bit above the disk. You know, there's a little galaxy in the first one that's above the disk a little bit. And so I can look up and get above the Milky Way where I can finally see something, and there it is. That little galaxy blown up is this guy right here. Barnard's galaxy, NGC 6822, is its typical numerical catalog designation. Okay, NGC 6822, and I'll pass this guy around so you can look at it up close. You can see there's a lot more than 40,000 stars there. You can, yeah, it looks like quite a few. But what you'll see is, notice these red nebulae, you know, those little, okay, this is a very active star-forming galaxy, just like they're saying, okay? And you've got stars condensing out of gas there, okay? So let me just pass that around, and after it comes back around, you know, get it back to me, so I'm going to use it in a little bit. But that is the galaxy they're talking about there. Barnard's galaxy, that's in the first super universe. The one object that we can see in a different super universe.
Now, this condensation into gas is a purely natural, physical happening.
I mean, there's all kinds of manipulation going on in the super universe level, but obviously out in the outer space levels, without power beings, you know, automatons end up being atoms, and atoms end up being stars, and, you know, okay.
But what would cause a big cloud of gas to start condensing into individuals?
Well, for one thing, you know, atoms have mass, and there's gravity.
Power force organisms.
Yeah, but gas is always...
If it's hot, you know, it's going to want to fly away. If it's cold, okay, you know, and something can kind of be a seed, or something can kind of get things started. But once things get started, for whatever reason, once you have some kind of a nucleus, you know, it's going to start drawing stuff towards it. An object is going to grow. Just simple linear gravity, okay? But that's there's three objects outside of the Milky Way that were finally recognized to be outside of the Milky Way by Hubble back in the late 20s, latter half of the 20s. That was the first one, and then it was the Triangulum Galaxy, and then the Andromeda Galaxy that we saw last time. Those are the first three galaxies that he deduced distances for and found that they were, you know, not anywhere near close. You know, that they were outside of the immediate region that we now call the Milky Way.
So how come...
Extragalactic. Besides the large and small Magellanic clouds.
When they first announced that Some of the things we thought were stars were actually a few hundred million suns. Wasn't that like a major holy cow moment?
Right, it's a big holy cow moment when you discover that tiny little fuzzy patch that you can see with the naked eye that was called the Andromeda Nebula, that you thought was some tiny little bit of gas somewhere in the Milky Way, is actually this collection of lots and lots and really lots of stars. Yeah. I mean, that was that huge, sort of leap out of a parochial universe. So that's okay, that's Barnard's galaxy. And see, and they're just pointing, trying to give you the difference of scale. That, you go to one of these big galaxies out in the outer space levels, and in a single phase of star formation, not over the whole lifetime of star formation, but just in one of those phases, you can have 100 million stars, being generated all at the same time. So it's a really, really big scaled up phenomenon. Okay, as opposed to, think about the little Andromeda Nebula that this, our sun came from. When all was said and done, there was only a million. Okay. See, and that is more on the on the scope of that sort of a thing. The Andromeda Nebula and large and small Magellanic clouds is these small scale worlds that condense into stars. Yep, so let's read some more.
Nebulae are not directly related to any of the administrative units, such as minor sectors or local universes, although some local universes have been organized from the products of a single nebula. Each local universe embraces exactly 1/100,000th part of the total energy charge of a superuniverse, irrespective of nebular relationship. For energy is not organized by nebulae, it is universally distributed.
Okay, so there's an example of the imposition of the power beings, of course. And it's not going on in the outer space levels, that sort of divvying up. But we mentioned this some, Nebadon was built out of a lot more than the Andromeda Nebula. That's only a million suns. You need a lot more of that than that to make Nebadon. But they're pointing out you do have some single nebulae that produce enough stars that you can make a whole local universe out of it. It's exactly 1/100,000th part of the total energy. If you look at it, you don't have this if you look at it in force or in matter, but if you look at it in terms of energy, you have this exact divvying of the total into 100,000 parts for the 100,000 local universes in a super universe. Wow. Okay. When all is said and done, there won't be any stray stuff. It'll all be all collected together into 100,000 packets, and each of them will have the exact same amount of energy that went into, that packet, that local universe.
Anytime anything's exactly distributed equally, without adjuster, each one is equal.
Yeah.
There's equality. Our equality has the spirit.
Right. It's a definite unity imposition, for that equality to exist. Yes. That exact divvying up of energy is in the sense of the grand universe being a universe of local universes. That unity fact, that it's one grand universe, is seen in this downstep fashion, that there's equality of all the local universes, because it's one turning. It's a universe of local universes. So it fundamentally has that unity, and you're seeing that each measure of energy is identical.
Would that replicate in the grids as they lay out the power grids for each local universe too, I would think, since it's a unity?
Well, the power grids are going to have to take into a lot of the individuality details. The total amount of energy in each is the same, but the internal structure is going to be very different in all of them. So
How do we get from here to there? I would think that there'd be some continuity of crossing over into other universes that you're somewhat familiar with.
Right. I mean, and that's basically because you don't just have a collection of 100,000 subgrids. There's one greater grid of the super universe.
Oh, that.
Right. See, I mean, so that's what the linkage is, between. You know, so you have a hierarchical grid. That's the, that's the way it's a hierarchical. Our energy grids are in the plane. but this is a hierarchical energy distribution grid that's, has its top node in the supreme power director of our super universe, and then it branches down from there. Okay. All right. So there's that.
Not all spiral nebulae are engaged in sun making. Some have retained control of many of their segregated stellar offspring, and their spiral appearance is occasioned by the fact that their suns pass out of the nebular arm in close formation, but return by diverse routes, thus making it easy to observe them at one point, but more difficult to see them when widely scattered on their different returning routes further out and away from the arm of the nebula. There are not many sun-forming nebulae active in Orvantan at the present time, though Andromeda, which is outside the inhabited superuniverse, is very active. This far-distant nebula is visible to the naked eye, and when you view it, pause to consider that the light you behold left those distant suns almost 1 million years ago.
Okay, so behold it and... All right, so there's Andromeda. They're wanting you to look at that image of Andromeda and recognize that the photons that went into making that image took 1 million years to get to the imager.
You're looking back in time.
Yeah, in a sense, yeah. You're looking at what the galaxy looked like 1 million years ago. When you look at an image like that. Okay, now... There's a whole bunch of subtexts to this. Yeah, right. You're looking at what the Andromeda Galaxy was like when Anna and Fanta. Yeah. Okay, so now the kind of things that are in the subtext here, okay, one is tied to the long discussion that we had last week about exactly what is the superuniverse of Orvantan. Okay, you have this very direct statement, okay, you could start with the notion, before you get to this paragraph, that the Milky Way galaxy is just one of many big galaxies that make up Orvantan, and that Andromeda and a whole bunch of other big galaxies are part of Orvantan, are part of the inhabited universe. And then you read this paragraph, and this paragraph refutes that initial assumption. That's not a valid initial assumption. Andromeda is in the first outer space level. It tells you they're point blank. It's not part of the inhabited superuniverse level. Okay? And in this picture where I'm, if I'm looking this direction towards the center of the Milky Way galaxy, and I look over here towards the first superuniverse, if I look not straight back, but back over about right there, Andromeda is right there in my field of view. It's not, it's not all the way 180 degrees back around, and it's above the plane. It's about right there. If we could see it in the sky right now, if this was the orientation, if your orientation is like this picture, that's where Andromeda would be. It's about right over there. So if you go to the planetarium and you put the stars in the dome in this orientation, you turn around and there will be that little fuzzy patch, in the planetarium, the Andromeda Galaxy. Andromeda. What was that?
Who named it Andromeda?
Well, it's in the constellation Andromeda, so it's the Andromeda Nebula. It's a little fuzzy spot in that direction of the sky. Yeah. Okay, so there's that. Okay, that very definitively is telling you Andromeda's not part of the superuniverse level. It's completely uninhabited. And you can really see that. If it was inhabited, you'd see some structure. It wouldn't be this perfectly smooth, grand spiral galaxy. You know, that shows no signs of micromanagement by power beings. Okay? The superuniverse space level, like they said, if you get up above it, there, you know, you would immediately recognize, oh, there are beings involved in what's going on here. You would never imagine that what you were seeing just happened naturally. It would look very artificial. It would look artful, you know, artificial, okay?
It would look organized.
It would look like it was organized by beings, okay? Because it is organized by beings, okay? I mean, no one looks at this table and wonders what natural process gave rise to that curious shape.
Yeah.
Okay? We know what mind made and personality managed looks like. Okay. Okay, now, the other little thing in there is that last little bit, that it left almost 1 million years ago. In other words, that Andromeda is almost 1 million light years away. If you, you know, look it up in a textbook or on Wikipedia or something like that, you know, you'll see they currently think it's roughly 2.5 million light years away. Okay?
It's actually how far?
It's actually not even 1 million.
Okay.
Which is still very far. And, oh, and I should, before I forget, another subtext there is, you know, there, to really consider, like they're saying, that it left almost 1 million years ago, that light, you know, relative to the size of the Milky Way. I mean, the Milky Way is only 500,000 light years across. See, this is, right, so that's what I was trying to get, you know, I mean, it's, they're saying even for them, when they contemplate, even 1 million light years, it's like, wow, that is really a long ways. That is like so outside of the scale that us beings could manage. I mean, you've got a super universe, you know, the main core of it, you know, that's roughly 500,000 in diameter. And because that's really as big as you can make something as a finite personality phenomenon and have it be manageable. Otherwise, it's just too far between point A and point B. I mean, angels only go 3 times the speed of light.
And I don't think that
the whole distance thing is grasped very well by people that discuss the whole idea of visitations from other beings. They don't seem to be grasping the distances we're really talking about here.
Right. I mean, to imagine, you know, like in the old Star Trek, the Kelvins coming from Andromeda, you know, and having, you know, those doings with Captain Kirk.
Yeah.
I mean, no. Yeah, never mind that it's uninhabited. But it's just wrap your mind around how big of a distance, you know, the distance that light travels in 1 million years is. I mean, it's just insane.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. I've mentioned, you know, occasionally when they have a sort of a direct little scientific fact like this, there's a context. It's not actually just that fact. It's that fact and some other facts together because they want you to put them together. They're not trying to reveal that any of the specific facts in the sentence. They're trying to reveal what you get when you put it all together. Well, there's nothing to put, you know, it's just a singular fact. They're telling you that it's almost 1 million light years away. It's basically 1 million light years away. Okay? And you go, well, that doesn't agree with current ideas. I mean, remember, if we could figure this number out accurately, they couldn't put this sentence in here. That would be a violation of the revelatory mandate. The only reason they can put that number in there is because it's impossible for us to actually figure it out. And it's like, well, how could that be? Well, if you look at this process over the last several decades, there's endless rumination. This is not a trivial issue to figure out how far away a galaxy is. Okay, there's all kinds of assumptions that are endlessly ruminated about. And the number that we think for the distance to Andromeda has changed a lot over the decades. Okay, because we're constantly, it's like, well, maybe not. I think about it. Maybe that assumption wasn't correct. You know, we keep changing the assumptions. The distances keep changing. And you know, even at a given point of time, there's 6 different people who have 6 different ideas. You know, okay, that's because, that should remind you that maybe there's some, this is not simple, maybe there's some issues. And this, and the fact that this number is here is telling you, yeah, there's insurmountable issues. No amount of you refining your ideas is ever going to get you the right answer, because there are things in play that you can't deduce.
Right.
Okay, and we've talked about that. There's all kinds of issues, you know, like the bound, you know, the region between the super universe level and the first outer space level and a million other things, okay, that we just don't, there's no way we can know unless it's revealed. So they're giving you a definite data point to help you, help us calibrate our distance determining methods. Okay? If you start with an initial assumption and you get an answer that isn't a little bit less than a million, you've got a false initial assumption. Okay? Try again. They're trying to give you something to help us constrain, okay, the process of calibrating these methods. The method is a relative method, maybe very fine. But it's absolute value. That's the problem. How do you calibrate it? Okay? You might note your weight to 10 decimal places, but if the zero point on the scale, you know, is at some random point, there's no accuracy. There's only precision.
And they don't drop things like that unless they are extremely relevant. Just the fact that that it's there places so much relevancy on it. There's so many things they could have added and they don't.
Right. They're just, it's very important because, I mean, it's just like with the dates in geology. I mean, the fundamental framework for understanding astronomy is the distance scale.
Yeah.
The fundamental framework for understanding geology is the time scale. If those are messed up, you know, it affects everything. Everything else is going to be negatively impacted by that incorrect starting point. So, yeah, and that's to your point. Okay, now the other thing that's in there, so there's that whole issue with Andromeda. Okay, so we got that pretty much nailed down. The other part there, that whole description, notice, you know, they're describing a spiral galaxy with the arms that we're all so familiar with. Okay, and, you know, like I mentioned, astronomers for decades have been trying to figure out why galaxies have that spiral pattern, you know, and why it seems to be so endurable, you know, why it isn't, you know, they can think of ways that you might get a spiral like that, but it would immediately wash away. But it's pretty obvious that these things just go on and on with these beautiful grand spiral patterns in them. Why are they so enduring? I mean, there's a lot of mystery to this. And one of the things that they certainly have played around with in recent decades is that it's some sort of a density phenomenon. Okay. Now notice that's basically what they're saying. They're just pointing out that the reason you can, you know, you have stars everywhere in the disk, but it's really easy to see the arms, even from a great distance, because the density of the stars in the arms is a lot higher. You know, when the density's low in between the arms, you know, unless you have a telescope that can really take a long exposure and, you know, zoom in on it, you know, it's almost like there's nothing there.
But isn't it also a feature of the turning aspect of the whole thing?
Right. But just, yeah, but that one step at a time here. Just the question of, so they're telling you that yes, it is a density thing, which now in recent decades we've suspected. But we have issues with that. We can't quite convince ourselves of some things. The problem is the thing we don't know about. See, you have these stars that have different densities, more density in the arms and less density in between, yes. But those stars are made out of atoms, and atoms are made out of ultimatons. And ultimatons are coupled to the force charge, and there's a whirl in the force charge. The thing that they don't know about, okay, is that you have this whirl in the force charge. Okay, so you don't just have density waves in a collection of billiard balls, which is the only thing they can think of. Okay, this is coupled to the whirl. So you can have some kind of billiard ball-like processes, like a simple notion of maybe for some reason stuff gets ejected in a bipolar fashion, opposite sides of a central core, two arms come out, you know, and then it's rotating, the billiard balls in those arms, it's all rotating, and so it wraps into a spiral. But it doesn't keep wrapping and wrapping and wrapping until it gets super tight. It just wraps a little bit, it appears, and then it's just like you've got this beautiful spiral painted on a record platter, okay? And it just goes around and around and doesn't get tighter and tighter, okay? See, and that's because there's more dynamics than just the billiard balls. Ultimately, the billiard balls are coupled to the force charge, and the force charge is rotating like a record platter in that whirl. And so you end up with a balance between the two. And there's a high degree to which those patterns that you can form through transient processes kind of get fixed to a high degree and then just go around and around. I mean, over a long span of time to wash out, but not just in a normal process, you make it go around three times and it's just going to be totally washed out. Okay.
And plus, most of these things have a central bar, and so there are really only two arms that are slowly wrapping, as opposed to
a whole bunch of a whole bunch. And of course, the bars are, like I've mentioned, are even more problematic. I mean, you can dream up some density wave, spiral density wave of the billiard balls, but a bar?
I know.
Right. I mean, and it's like, well, it must be like just a flash. No, you look at it. It's like, it's obvious that bar is going to be there for a long time.
It's almost like it's spewing out these arms that just keep coming.
There's a whole bunch of other mysteries in play, too, about why a bipolar, ejection like this. The thing that we're seriously missing, see, is the fact that there's a force charge and there's a whirl in it, and that the ultimatons are coupled to it. If we knew there was something like that, it's like, oh, okay, even if I don't understand all the details, obviously it's potentially explainable now that you set up some sort of a standing structure in the force charge because of this coupling. It's just like the electrons going around the nucleus of an atom. Those electrons are made out of ultimatons, and those ultimatons are coupled to the force charge. And so, they may be spinning around hyper fast, but they're spinning around in a three-dimensional context, coupled to the force charge, making waves in that force charge, and you set up standing waves in the force charge. So there's these distributions of differential in the force charge immediately around it. And that's why we think that there's these clouds or these orbitals, when we try to analyze electrons. So it's a similar thing with the galaxy. You can have this extended standing structure that's it's kept regenerated because it's not like you make some sort of like a wave in the force charge and then it just dissipates because there's a constant regeneration of it, like with the electron. It continues to go around and regenerate it. Okay? So you get this relatively, in the case of the galaxy, constant structure that's pushing on the stars and the stars are pushing on it, and then it's a mutual balance. And so you can get these giant macroscopic patterns that stay. Okay. All right. So that's what's going on there. Yeah, the last two. Yep.
The Milky Way galaxy is composed of vast numbers of formal spiral and other nebulae, and many still retain their original configuration. But as a result of internal catastrophes and external attraction, many have suffered such distortion and rearrangement as to cause these enormous aggregations to appear as gigantic, luminous masses of blazing suns like the Magellanic Cloud. The globular type of star clusters predominates near the outer margins of Orbontan.
Okay, just look at that again and remind yourself of the pictures. There's the Large Magellanic Cloud, which is what they're referring to there, basically. And you can see it doesn't look like any sort of a nice spiral or anything anymore because it's gotten pretty tidally disrupted in the gravity of the Milky Way. And so it's just kind of a oddball looking aggregation. But you can see there too, there's some star formation, little clouds of gas in there. And then here's a globular cluster, like they're referring to. Remember what that looks like. Okay. And like we mentioned last time, those big spherical collections of stars, we see them in a halo, kind of a spherical halo, all around, you know, the disk in the middle, the Milky Way galaxy, you know, in the middle of that spherical distribution. You've got these little balls hung like Christmas tree ornaments, you know, in a spherical distribution all around, okay, the region, the volume of space that has the disk inside of it, okay? All right, so that's just, you know, what they're referring to there. Just noticing that beginning, the Milky Way galaxy is composed of vast numbers. Okay, again, reminding you that by and large, this Milky Way galaxy is not like that Andromeda galaxy, which is, you know, basically a single system, astronomic system. It sounds like essentially you have just a whirl. And then little things are being made and brought into the whirl, as opposed to very much getting ultimatons and hence gas directly out of the whirl of the Milky Way itself. Doesn't sound like they really did much in the way of, you know, actualization, more, you know, metamorphosis of energy of the whirl itself. The whirl is sort of the backdrop into which all of these smaller objects, a vast number, have been collected over eons. Okay? So very different than all of the endless millions of these things out in the outer space levels, these great big things, which are, you know, you can see some littler objects near it that are obviously going to get incorporated in eventually. You know, there's some little galaxies nearby that are going to be drawn into Andromeda there. But essentially, you know, most of Andromeda was a single construct, a single giant whirl that was condensed into ultimatons. All right, last little bit here.
The vast star clouds of Orvontan should be regarded as individual aggregations of matter comparable to the separate nebulae observable in the space regions external to the Milky Way galaxy. Many of the so-called star clouds of space, however, consist of gaseous material only. The energy potential of these stellar gas clouds is unbelievably enormous, and some of it is taken up by nearby suns and redispatched in space as solar emanations.
Okay, so the main point there is because of this, the Milky Way galaxy is this collection. They're reminding you that even if there's been quite a bit of distortion of what was collected, you still end up with, you know, there's this kind of this star cloud here and this star cloud here. There's sort of collections of stars in the disk of the Milky Way. And you can think of them to a high degree, like we were talking about last time, as this planet-like object that's orbiting about a center, you know, a sun-like center. So you can think of them, you know, as individual aggregations, see? Okay? So that function in a relatively separate, individuated sort of a way. But, you know, not all nebulae, you know, are condensed into stars, or even never maybe will condense. You know, you can just have a cloud of gas. Okay, but like this is just a last little thing. You know, when you looked at Barnard's galaxy and I passed it around, you could see those. I mean, there's actually a whole bunch of gas there that you can't see, but near a star that's forming and giving off a lot of ultraviolet, it's lighting up the gas immediately nearby, ionizing the hydrogen, and so that it emits light and we can see it. So part of the clouds of gas here get lit up by the star in the center. If you notice, like this ring looking thing here, you know, has a star smack in the middle of it, see? That's giving off ultraviolet, that's lighting up that gas, so making it visible. But there's gas beyond that. It's just it's not being lit up, so you can't see it. Okay, and you know, they're kind of alluding to, you've got this huge collection of matter. You know, that's a cloud of gas that has mass. You know, not to mention all this unrecognized energy that's bottled up inside of the atoms of that gas. There's a lot of energy there. That you drag all that into a star, you either collect it together and form a star, or, you know, a star is already formed and it pulls in a bunch of gas. Either way, just recognizing it's a huge amount of energy they're pointing to that's going to get spent. The star is going to burn that energy. Okay.
Given that they're telling us that the Milky Way is basically just the center or the core of Orvontan, have you kind of worked out what's the total size of Orvontan?
Well, again, I mean, you know, that's what we were kind of talking about last time. I mean, the galaxy is about 500,000 light years in diameter, and there's just, you know, not too much side to side, you know, beyond that. I mean, you go just a little ways and you got the dark gravity bodies, you go just a little bit ways and you got the semi-quiescent zone. You know, there is a little bit more space front and back and above and below, you know, and there's little galaxies like.
But that part that we look out and we see these arms of the Milky Way, that what we're able to observe of the Milky Way is, I mean, I guess, I don't even know how to ask my question. So
okay. I mean,
well, we're kind of inside a little bit too.
Right. So we're definitely see. Inside. And I mean, those arm. You know, we try to deduce the arm structure. It's very hard, though, on the inside. And like we were mentioning last time, we don't know about all this structure and all these motions. And so there's all kinds of distortions.
We think there's a central bar at the center.
Right. And there's a bunch of things. You know, we'll see. It's like, well, it looks like there's kind of, it's denser here. This must be an arm. And okay, an arm. You know, it can't be just those little chunks we can see. So we it must go on around like this. You know, a lot of it is extrapolation and whatnot. You know, we can't see very much directly. Okay. Okay, so next time we'll get into a little bit more of we'll kind of zoom in and even more and get some details about different ways that stars and planets and similar objects form. That's what the next section is about. I hope that in the way we've talked about it here, that it has, you. The challenge with a lot of this, a lot of the revelation, when it's talking about science, even some other areas too, if you have any exposure to that area of human thought, initially the book will come off as antiquated. It'll go, this sounds like it was written in the 30s, okay? And yes, it was. But what they're trying to do is get us to not be quite so snooty about modern times and recognize that, by and large, what the words and the basic ideas that you had back in the beginning of the 20th century are adequate to the task. A lot of times, rather than throwing out an idea, when you found it to not be very adequate, the problem is not that it's inadequate fundamentally, is that you need to step back and get a bigger picture and understand how you can generalize that idea. Use that idea in a more objective context. And so, you know, the use of nebula is definitely like that. They're trying to they're not trying to take us back to that old mode of thinking. They're trying to show you that there was a truth potential that you lost in that. That when you kind of got rid of a more generalized notion of nebulae, you start to get in this very, you know, it starts to get too individuated, too billiard ball-like. You start to lose sight of the big picture. I mean, this is kind of, just one last little thought, this is kind of what you were bringing up. I mean, it's very important to have the language of science always reminding you that even though you're studying individuality, it doesn't mean there's not unity. And having generalized terms just reminds you of that. Using energy in a general sense as well as a specific sense, nebula, you know, in a more general sense, etc. Those kind of simple things are important. It's not just they had no choice but to use what's now outdated language. That's been a very common way of thinking about the way the Urantia book feels, you know, when you read it, sort of the flavor of it. And challenge that response that you have, if you have it. If you don't, fine. But if you have that, see it afresh. See how they're not trying to take you back. They're trying to get you to not lose valuable modes of thought that had just were just starting to coalesce several decades ago, and then you let go of them. Continue their coalescence, you know, bring them to fruit and use them in a very productive way like they do in the Revelation.
Did people in the 30s know about the Magellanic Cloud and everything that it was doing?
Some of the basic stuff, yes.
Some of it was known, but I think, like Steve said, you know, there's not a sentence that any human being could have written.
Yeah, really.
And that's kind of what I'm saying. I mean, to really appreciate that, if you're seeing the book from a more objective perspective, it is immediately obvious everywhere that that isn't just some sentence that someone wrote, some human wrote, you know, or that was pulled directly out of some human source work, you know, with no greater consciousness applied to it,
yeah.
Right? Okay. It's all very subtly used and modified.
But if you've got your ego really wrapped up in what modern scientific thought says is the truth, then you're going to really struggle.
Yeah. But it's just really important for modern man to remind themselves that there were better thinkers 100 years ago than now. And they just intuitively used language in a better way. We need to go back to that and then take it forward. Okay? You can't really do anything with what we've got now. It's too muddled and devoid of intuition. There was still cosmic intuition under the surface of human scientific thought back then. And it subtly wove its way into the way they talked about things and stuff. We threw that out. We need to go back to that. Okay?
Okay.
All right. Let's take a moment here.